This is Funk Punk and the Blues. We'll be hearing about two Ohio-based musics, popular music. Jason Hasley will talk to us about funk in Dayton. We'll hear from David N. Lewis again, but he's changing hats and talking about underground punk. And what's that?
In Ohio,
right. And Roberta Freund Schwartz will be talking to us about the blues. So first up, we have Jason Hasley. He's got an MS in African American Studies at IU. Oh, I'm sorry, MA. And he's currently at the Archives of African American Music and Culture, and they've been collecting post-war African American music of various sorts. And I think he's been working on some oral history of Dayton musicians, funk musicians. So here we go.
Show on the road here.
Okay, well, compared to a state such as Tennessee, with its dual musical centers of Memphis and Nashville, Ohio doesn't seem to get as much attention from popular music historians. I kind of weigh those words rather here in this. But Ohio's several major cities. Cincinnati has perhaps received the most attention, due to the prolific independent record label King Records having been based there for 30 years, which you've just heard about. King's artist roster included funk pioneer James Brown, who was practically the label's only popular act during the last years of its existence. But 54 miles northeast of Cincinnati is located the city of Dayton. Unlike its neighbor to the south, it was never the home of any nationally recognized record labels, but it did have a musical culture and a sound that owed its existence partially to the funk and soul innovations of James Brown. With the veteran Ohio players at the vanguard of this movement, Dayton funk bands such as Lakeside, Slave, Phase O, Sun, Platypus, and Zap, among others, created a sound that was indigenous to Dayton, yet popular worldwide. The proliferation of this Dayton funk sound was not dependent upon regional independent labels and two-minute singles, because this new musical style came to prominence just as the major record labels began to recognize and aggressively market black popular music in the same manner they had been marketing rock music. Now, unlike their contemporaries, or their counterparts in many other urban centers, Dayton's black youngsters who were musically inclined were more apt to form bands as opposed to singing groups. Many of the Dayton-bred musicians cite the music programs in their schools as their initial exposure to playing musical instruments. As a result, the Dayton acts were self-contained ensembles, not dependent on a decent backup band to back them up, because they were the band. Now, in 1962, a group of young Dayton musicians backed up the seminal R&B group The Falcons, featuring Wilson Pickett on lead vocals, on their hit record, I Found the Love. Billed at the time as the Ohio Untouchables, this aggregation would soon evolve into the pioneering funk ensemble, the Ohio Players, who were among the first bands to introduce the urban funk sound to mainstream audiences. Let me show you something here. And I want to play you something here. An example of the record I'm referring to. I think. Okay, it must be back. Now, you may remember this song if you were around in 1962.
Oh,
that goes. Well, after their beneficial association with the hit-making Falcons, the Ohio Untouchables were granted the opportunity to record several singles under their own name on the Lupine and Thelma labels. There's a picture of one of the labels there, Lupine Singles. Unfortunately, these releases were not successful, and the Ohio Untouchables' mercurial leader, Robert Ward, fired the band. Regrouping, the band recruited several new members, including guitarist and reluctant vocalist Leroy Sugarfoot Bonner, and changed their name to the Ohio Players. Here are a couple of examples of some of their early works. This is from 1968. It's a crying shame on the Compass label. After a decade of scuffling, personnel changes, and marginal success, the Ohio Players finally achieved real stardom with their first album on Detroit's Westbound label, intriguingly titled Pain. And of course, here's the, hit single coming up here. From 1971 on the Westbound label. Now, with each subsequent album, the Players garnered an increased amount of popularity, culminating in a string of million-selling singles, including... I'll let this one finish up for you. The Funky Worm in 1973, Skin Tight in 1974, Fire in 1975, and Love Roller Coaster in 1976. The latter two songs topped both the soul and pop charts, a rare achievement for a black funk band at the time. The band's accomplishments would reflect many of the changes occurring in the black music industry during the 1970s. And their success would initiate an explosion of talented funk bands hailing from Dayton. Groups such as Slave, Lakeside, Sun, Platypus, Heatwave, and Phazo emerged just as the Ohio Players' popularity was beginning to wane. And they soon found themselves recording for major record labels, churning out a funk sound indigenous to their southern Ohio roots. Now, none of these groups would achieve the same across-the-board popularity as the Ohio Players, but several acts did achieve marginal crossover success. Slave had the biggest pop crossover hit with their first single released, Slide, in 1977. Lakeside had a moderate pop hit with Fantastic Voyage in 1981. Heatwave, which although based in Europe, contained two Dayton-bred brothers at its core, achieved the greatest crossover recognition with three top 10 R&B hits, two of which also going top 10 pop. As impressive as these singles chart rankings were, the success of these groups came about at the end of a shift in the way black pop acts were being marketed. By the late 1970s, it wasn't enough to simply sell singles. Album sales were now standard in all forms of pop, were all the standard in all forms of popular music. And by the beginning of the 1960s, race-based musical designations began to blur, so much so that Billboard suspended publication of their R&B chart at the end of 1963, citing too little difference between it and the Hot 100 chart rankings. Now, little did they know at the time that the Brill Building song mills, which were supplying both pop and R&B singers material interchangeably, were about to be displaced by self-contained British bands that wrote much of their own material. The British invasion irrevocably affected white pop music while having practically no impact at all on black pop, at least at the time. By the end of the decade, most cutting-edge rock music was found on long-playing albums. It's interesting to note that an artist as influential as Jimi Hendrix only had one single to reach the Billboard Top 40 chart, while his albums sold in the millions. Hendrix, during his lifetime, primarily appealed to white record buyers in spite of his race. The preeminent black pop style of the era, soul, was still achieving its best sales with 45 RPM discs. However, as soul gave way to a new and radical musical form known as funk, the 45 RPM single would prove inadequate, and black pop music would follow its white counterpart in adapting the long play album format. The funk godfather James Brown's jams were initially released as two-sided singles that would invariably kill the groove when the listener was forced to turn the disc over in the middle of the song. Certainly, George Clinton's P-Funk Flights of Outrageous Fancy could never be contained on singles. As the artist's musical messages began to exceed the 2.5-minute mark, the long play format proved indispensable. The album would prove crucial to funk. Now, funk was black pop's equivalent to the progressive, psychedelic, and metallic album-oriented music that young whites began to embrace during the late 1960s. However, while young white listeners moved from purchasing singles to albums such as The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Jimi Hendrix's Are You Experienced, young black consumers generally continued in the mode of buying singles well into the early 1970s. This may account for the inordinately large number of black records reaching the upper ranks of Billboard's pop charts during this period. In actuality, if most charts had not maintained a policy of factoring in airplay along with sales, there would have been an even greater presence of black records on the pop charts. Now, what accounted for this dichotomy was the supposed gap in economic status between young white and black consumers. It was maintained by the recording industry that black consumers had significantly less disposable income to spend on long play albums. Consequently, black artists were not encouraged to craft thematically complex concept albums. The successful black independent label Motown had several best-selling albums in its catalog by the late 1960s, but albums were not a priority for Motown at the time, as most of their LPs consisted merely of collections of hit singles, with a few exceptions. Amazingly, it was Motown's southern rival Stax Records, which inadvertently ushered in the transition to an album-oriented black pop music industry with Isaac Hayes' idiosyncratic Hot Buttered Soul in 1969. Hot Buttered Soul was a fluke, a throwaway release simply meant to fulfill Stax President Al Bell's ambitious goal of creating an instant catalog to replace the one lost when Stax severed the distribution arrangement with Atlantic Records the previous year. Hot Buttered Soul contained only four tracks, with the hit, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, clocking in at 18-plus minutes. This record obviously did not have pop radio play in mind, yet managed to garner significant airplay on pop, soul, and jazz stations, albeit with a severely edited version of the hit song. Not to be undone, other soul artists followed Hayes' lead and created album-length opuses such as Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and Stevie Wonder's series of influential early to mid-70s albums. Yet the single didn't simply go away, not yet. Black singles continued to sell briskly through the mid-1970s, culminating in the awarding of the first platinum single, 2 Million Sold, to Johnny Taylor's Disco Lady in 1976. This triumph in many ways represents the beginning of the end of the soul era, as the black music styles popular during the previous decade began to fall out of favor with younger black record buyers. Just like album format, the trend towards self-contained ensembles began to permeate black popular music approximately a decade later than had in rock music. With this change in musical taste, many of the older styles that had been popular in the 1960s and early 70s, such as falsetto-led stand-up vocal groups and southern blues-inspired hard soul, began to diminish in popularity to be supplanted by the emerging and divergent styles of funk and disco. Many black middle-class teenagers reared in suburban areas also began to embrace the album-oriented rock music popular among their white neighborhood peers. With the ranks of the black middle class swelling, young blacks began to purchase more albums, eventually catching up with their white counterparts. Self-contained funk bands replaced the older forms of black pop almost as quickly and radically as the British beat groups displaced the American teen idols in the mid-1960s. And additionally, a new phenomenon began to occur in music industry during the late 1960s. Major labels that had previously ignored soul music began either buying out or otherwise dwarfing smaller independent labels that specialized in various forms of black music, which had primarily been featured on independent labels up to this point. Dayton's funk group, the Ohio Players, which achieved its initial success on the Detroit independent label Westbound, was eventually wooed over to the major Mercury Records. The Ohio Players went through a messy, well-documented separation from Westbound, which did not take the group's defection lying down, releasing two unauthorized albums of Ohio Players' outtakes, Climax and Rattlesnake, to compete with their concurrent Mercury releases. Mercury, now a part of the Dutch-German conglomerate PolyGram, was one of a half dozen major record labels defined as such because they control every aspect of the manufacture and distribution of their product. Now, virtually all of the later Dayton funk bands recorded for major labels or custom labels distributed by a major, Lakeside, for instance, was signed to Solar, an independent label that was distributed by, at various times, both RCA and WEA, Warner. Slave was signed to Cotillion, a subsidiary of Atlantic, which had once been an independent R&B powerhouse, but since 1967 had been owned by Warner Reprise Records. Zapp was signed directly to Warner Reprise. The Dayton group, the Overnight Low, released two singles, one each, on Chess and Deluxe labels, both Midwestern independents, then on the wane. After changing their name to Sun, they signed with Capitol in 1976, which of course is a major label owned by EMI. The age of independent label was that specialized in black music was rapidly coming to an end, Motown notwithstanding. And the majors began to look at the funk bands as album-oriented acts that could generate album sales. Time, how am I on time? Oh, great. Okay, the controversy engendered by, whole section there. Okay, the Dayton Funksters not only helped to usher in an era of album-oriented black pop musically, but in a non-musical fashion as well. If black pop albums had been rare prior to the 1970s, images of black people on albums, whether they were performers or models, were even scarcer. Often the covers of albums by black artists featured white models, abstract graphics, or cartoons in lieu of a photograph or realistic rendering of the performer. This sort of subterfuge had been implemented by the record industry based on the belief that black images would discourage the stocking of albums in stores frequented by white record-buying consumers. This discriminatory practice began to be relaxed with the advent of album-oriented black pop. Black images were suddenly prevalent once black became beautiful in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. Perhaps no act was bolder in this regard than the Dayton Funk veterans, the Ohio Players, in their explicit displays of the black female form. Their early Westbound albums, Pain, Pleasure, and Ecstasy, featured bald-headed model Pat Evans in various sadomasochistic poses and situations suggested by the album title. With their move to Mercury, the Sleeves continued in a similar vein. Perhaps the most controversial cover was Honey, a gatefold sleeve which featured a woman covered in the self-same foodstuff. As a Players member, okay, I'll skip the quote there. But the controversy engendered by the Players' album covers seemed to inspire their other Dayton groups to feature similarly outrageous, albeit less sexually explicit, graphics on their sleeves. Sun, inspired by the recent movie hit Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, opted for galactic science fiction theme for their costumes and album covers. Slave utilized a vaguely Afrocentric approach, perhaps in connection with their controversial moniker. And Lakeside, they were pretty, they used quite a bit of variety. They were Robin Hood and their Merry Men. They were, cowboys, things of that nature. Now, funk historian Ricky Vincent, in his book, Funk, the Music, the People, and the Rhythm on the One, classified funk music in several distinct subcategories, with most of the Dayton funk bands listed under monster funk of the late 1970s and naked funk of the early 80s. Now, these don't really mean anything to the layman, I suppose, but it's safe to say that that the early Ohio Players albums were steeped in jazz and blues influences. According to former Ohio Players member Greg Webster, the band wanted to play jazz. Pain, which we heard earlier, was a jazz tune, but it had a funk beat to it, and if the audience wanted to dance to it, it was cool. Meanwhile, one could classify many of the post-Ohio Players bands as disco funk due to the contemporary dance-friendly rhythms integrated into the funk groove. They also emerged at a time when electronic instrumentation was beginning to replace conventional horns and percussion. After traditional soul music fell out of favor with younger record buyers, its offspring, funk and disco, initially took separate paths, but as funk soon returned to its primarily urban fan base, disco exploded onto the mainstream cultural scene. Often under pressure from their labels, the Dayton Funksters were compelled to incorporate dance-oriented disco elements such as metronomic beat and synthesizers at the expense of the polyrhythmic multi-instrumental funk groups. This intended effort to appeal to a wider audience was questioned by critics, but as Chris Jones of the group Dayton explained, try to keep in mind that what the industry is doing. If you have disco going on and funk going on, you're trying to compromise for both, and the record company, of course, is breathing down your neck. Now, the Dayton funk era ebbed in the mid-1980s in the wake of the newer urban sounds emanating from Minneapolis and Atlanta, not to mention the burgeoning hip-hop scene. However, its legacy continues in many ways. The drawly vocal style of the Ohio Players' Leroy Sugarfoot Bonner was appropriated by both Lionel Richie of the Commodores and Larry Blackman of Cameo. The vocoder and mic'd hand clap sound popularized by Roger Troutman of Zapp has found its way into numerous rap records and directly inspired the Tupac Dr. Dre collaboration California Love. Numerous other samples have been culled from previously obscure Dayton funk jams. Fazo's Ridin' High has been sampled by nearly a dozen rappers, and Snoop Dogg transformed Slaves Watching You into the infamous Gin and Juice. And I'll just give you an example of some of these appropriations here. Now this is Zapp's More Bounce to the Ounce from 1980. Repetitious, isn't it? And this is a sample by a group called EPMD.
To the sounds of your PMZ, but you should keep quiet while the MC rap. But if you're tired, then go take a nap or stay awake and watch the show I take, because right now I'm about to shake.
And coming up is Fazo's Ridin' High, and I'll kind of skip through a little bit of this. And here is the sampled version by EPMD.
Yo, what's up, Pig? Yo, nut man, just cool and kick back in the studio with DJ Scratch and my man Frank B. Reminiscing about how we was trying to shop our demo and everybody was dishing, you know what I'm saying?
Yo, P, tell him what's up, man.
We was cooling in my car one day, you see. Clocking a double nickel on the LIE.
I'm gonna fast forward this a bit.
10 o'clock. Turn on the tunes to hear the
This is Slaves Watching You, 1979, I think. But it was appropriated years later by Snoop Dogg as Gin and Juice.
Laid back.
Okay, well, for better or worse, the sexual objectification of black women as pioneered by the Ohio Players album sleeves continues in today's music videos. Now, although only recently acknowledged as a prominent subgenre of black music, the Dayton brand of street funk contributed to the music industry more than just artistically. It helped usher in album-oriented black popular music. Thank you. Didn't they use a Tinny Car radio to gauge the
speaker there for the to check how to mix the 45 singles. They demoed it, how they would do it different ways.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm curious, you've discussed the albums and the singles, but how much of this was during the growth of the concert scene? What financial portion of this was taken care of by the live appearances of the people, or were they just simply promoting their records by
concert
appearances?
That's a good question. How can I answer that? Because I know typically, hearing a lot of record company owners at the time, when approached as to why their artists never got royalties, they said, well, we're helping them out. We're helping them put a record out so they can make their money gigging. In the early 70s, I suspect that was starting to change a bit. I think people were becoming more sophisticated in terms of what to expect from record companies. Not that they necessarily got it, but, I think record sales, were becoming more of an issue in terms of artists, in terms of, they were kind of keeping up with the bottom line, especially seeing that they were making, artistic contributions to the works.
All right, we're going to need to move along to the next one.